Welcome to The Great Humbling. I'm Dugald Hine, co-founder of the Dog Mountain Project and A School Called Home. In the spring of 2020, I began recording these conversations with the poet and recovering sustainability consultant, Ed Gillespie. We call them The Great Humbling because this feels like a time of being humbled, brought down to earth and, if we're lucky, back into connection with land and soil and with each other. Thank you for listening.
All right, Ed, it's my first Monday morning back at my desk of 2024. What better way to start the year than to be back again for the second half of this series of The Great Humbling with you? How are you? Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year to you too. Well, I'm in fine fettle, actually. I'm sat at my desk looking out of the window downstream of the Chet. There's an angler sat in the crisp January sunshine with his rod and a seagull looking on with interest, which is not dissimilar to a vignette I saw last week when I was walking along the river. And there was just this wonderful scene of fishermen wrapped up in what was quite a cold day and about literally 4 or 5 yards from him along the bank was a heron just stood there. Like right next to him going, I'm going to get the fish before you. But just this wonderful sort of camaraderie of the two fishermen, one avian and one human, stood next to each other in the cold.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I'm talking of the cold. I'm looking out of the window and the snow is gently falling and it feels like it has been doing for about 2 months. I mean, it hasn't actually, but we've had snow on the ground since early November. I was talking to somebody yesterday who lives just outside of our little town, and he said, "Oh yeah, we live down by, you know, by Jedvik on the lake, and our son, he likes driving his car out on the ice in the winter." But this year the snow came so early that there's not that much ice under it, because if it's frozen just a little and then the snow comes, then it's kind of insulated and it doesn't freeze deep. So no cars on the ice this winter, Ed.
Do you know what? I can remember a UK winter from my childhood where there were cars on the Broads.
Wow.
So that's probably way back in the 70s. But also you telling that anecdote reminds me of when I was in Siberia on Lake Baikal, on my, you know, flight free circumnavigation, where, you know, obviously they drive all over the ice during the winter because it gets so thick. But then there is this weird transition period in spring where the ice starts to break up and it's too volatile to drive on it. But you also can't get a boat through it because it's still too thick and in huge chunks. So I went to Olcon Island, which is an island in the lake. Very weird sort of shamanic place. It's quite beautiful. But you had to ride a hovercraft to get out there, this sort of padushka, which allowed you to navigate this sort of surface of broken ice. But what they say there as well is also when the ice is breaking up, vehicles often disappear and you don't know where they've gone, because what happens is the ice sort of just pivots. So they'll be driving across a big sheet of ice, which will then tip, and the vehicle will go plunging into the ice, and then the ice basically just slips back into position. So you don't know where people have gone. Yes, I didn't mean to start us off on a sinister note.
Maybe this is setting the tone for the year, Ed. Maybe it's going to be that kind of year, going through the ice and not knowing where you've gone.
But do you feel like this is your first like really proper Swedish winter then?
I said to one of our neighbours, I said, this is the kind of winter that I imagined when I was moving to Scandinavia. Yeah. Like, it's been a real kind of Christmas card, Christmas, you know, I had to dig my way out. The day before Christmas Eve, Anna and Alfie had already set off to her parents for the holidays and the day that school broke up. And I stuck around for a couple more days to tie up some loose ends and keep the cats company. And then I was due to get in the car and head down to join them. Took me all morning to dig out the drive before I could set off. So I now know, like snowed in is no longer a metaphor for me. It's a lived experience. So yeah, that's been my winter so far.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because yeah, it's been very weird here. I mean, it's cool now, probably more authentic January weather. But I mean, I have blossom on the trees in my garden, and I actually spotted apple blossom on the apple tree on my allotment in December. But there's been a few things sort of coming into bud already, which is probably a false hope, because we're almost certainly bound to get some extreme cold weather in between, aren't we? But it's that sort of polar vortex oscillation thing that's going on, where you can have really mild weather in one place and it cold enough to freeze your contact lenses onto your eyeballs somewhere else.
Yeah, I was just reading an advanced copy of Leah Rampey's book, Earth and Soul, which is a great sort of collection of both stories of and tools for the processes by which we allow ourselves to be changed in order to come alive to what's called for by the times around and ahead of us. But there's a bit early on where she's just like, there's all these terms that we didn't know 10 years ago that have come into our vocabulary, you know, whether it's like polar vortex or atmospheric river or derecho, I think is one of these ones that she's talking about from where she is in North America. And yeah, they become items of items of conversation. We have new ways of talking about the weather because we have new weather.
Yeah, pyrocumulonimbus.
There you go.
The one that always scares me. Which, if you don't know, it is the one which is electrical storms that start their own fires.
Yeah. Yeah, on that jolly note, Ed, what have you been reading?
Actually, to bring some mischievous levity into the mix, I did actually, after enjoying and revelling so much in John Higgs's KLF book, I actually went and read Bill Drummond's little biography, 45, which is really interesting because obviously it's over 20 years old now. So the Bill Drummond we now know and love is in his mid-60s, but this was written when he was sort of at the post-peak of his provocations in the late 90s. And it's just really lovely. I found out also that Bill Drummond lived in Norwich for several years, which is obviously my hometown, which I had no idea about. So that was a nice link. But it was making me laugh because the book is, as you would imagine, not exactly a chronology. It's a sort of series of loosely connected chapters, but there's one that I...
It's just not a chronology, it's a chirology.
Yeah, exactly. But there's one particular one that just comes to mind where he's invited to Belfast to this place called College Green House, which had been a sort of place where loads of people had stayed over the years, sort of a squat and sort of temporary accommodation. And a local artist had curated a whole bunch of guests to come and do installations or pieces in anyone who had stayed in this property could come and do a piece for this like one night. So Bill decides he's going to make soup for everyone and sets about sort of arriving in Belfast far too late. The shops are all shut. He can't get any ingredients. And then it just goes to this sort of mad scene of trying to cook soup for dozens of people with, you know, four inadequately sized saucepans. And yeah, it's so simple, but so, so beautifully funny and brilliant.
It sounds great. I thought there was going to be pizza involved when you mentioned Belfast, but there's Belfast culinary stories are part of this this series. Clearly,
I'm going to open every episode with one.
Anything else you've been reading over the break?
Yeah, and a book that I picked up on a complete whim, mainly because I'm a big fan of David Mitchell, the comedian, and I really enjoy his work. And you know, I'm not into the monarchy by any stretch of the imagination, but I was. So his book Unruly, which is sort of history of the kings and queens of England, largely of England, bit of Scotland, and it again, it's one of those like pleasant surprises. I mean, it's fairly foul-mouthed. It's certainly very irreverent. I'm hoping it's pretty historically accurate. I know he did a history degree, so I think he sort of knows his onions. And I imagine he probably did a fair amount of professional academic consultation to make sure that he wasn't talking nonsense. But it's a pretty ribald history of the UK monarchy. And there's just a few things that really stuck in my mind. I mean, I knew this, I think, but I hadn't quite grasped the significance of it. But, you know, the very fact that the Normans from northern France were actually Scandinavians, because they were Northmen. So, you know, this is basically your compatriots now, your adopted nation, invaded France and then invaded England from France, as well as invading England from the other side as well.
And founding Russia and various other things.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, exactly. So I guess that penny hadn't quite dropped for me. But and then the sort of just the ridiculous stuff that the monarchy does or used to do, like these arranged marriages between infants, you know, these sort of power-broking relationships where you sort of promise your two-year-old son will marry someone else's one-year-old daughter. And it's like, really? It's like they're barely out of the womb. And what struck me as well, and we're all familiar with that kind of, you know, accession to the throne and the first in line and primogeniture in the techno jargon. But David Mitchell talks a lot about porphyrogeniture, which I'd never heard of, which is this hilarious rule of succession whereby the son born to a king who is in office has first dibs on the throne over their elder siblings who were born before daddy took office. And this is just, it just seems to me a way of gerrymandering, you know, around the first in line type of challenge and going, well, it's not as cut and dried as that. And actually, we're going to elevate so-and-so to the throne instead. Yeah, so there's all that sort of stuff, you know, and the fact that Lady Jane Grey, you know, was on the throne for less time than Liz Truss was in office. But, I mean, what you basically come out of it with is this sense that, oh my God, the history is really one of absolutely psychopathic power grabs, complete dysfunctionality. You know, there's loads of kings who die really early or quite suddenly because of the, you know, the poor health of people in those eras. So, you know, they very quickly vanish with chronic sickness, having fought tooth and nail to get on the throne, and they then don't last very long. There is, as we were just alluding to, this very weird and very complex relationship with France, you know, and this kind of notion of a greater Albion, but also this overriding notion that a lot of it was about better the devil you know. It didn't matter if the king was an absolute arse, but at least you knew where you were with that particular arse. And the sort of tolerance of uncertainty and the bloodletting and literal wars that could go on for years when they weren't sure who would take the throne. It was almost like, okay, well, we'll take the idiot over the uncertainty because at least it avoids a conflagration. That and the fact that some of the things that we hold most dear, like Parliament and Magna Carta, actually happened, you know, as mechanisms to deal with idiot monarchs. You know, they're not done out of some kind of high aspiration. They were sort of done through desperation in order to control the vagaries of someone who's been put on the throne, supposedly through divine right. And, you know, unfortunately, God chose a twat. So we're going to have to do something about that. So, yeah, it made me laugh. I learnt a lot. And my God, I defy anyone who's a monarchist to read it and not question their own commitments.
Monarchist listeners, please take Ed up on that. Read or listen to David Mitchell's Unruly and get back to us and let us know your side of the argument. But it's funny because I realise I've been in a kind of season of you know, of heavy reads, because that's what I do. When the work lessens and it's that kind of wintering phase. And so I finally got round to David Wengrow and David Graeber's The Dawn of Everything. But I've also simultaneously with that, or in parallel with that or something, I've been listening to as an audiobook Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism,
Yeah, you really have gone for some light winter reads, haven't you?
I know, but the, I think I probably thought the origins of totalitarianism would be like more. I'm not sure I was expecting it to be as compelling and fascinating a kind of broad historical narrative as it actually is, for all that, you know, it's coming out of this incredibly dark moment in European history and a reckoning with it and so on. But, you know, because she's going back into the sort of the institutions of nation states and the making of nation states on the journey into modernity, and this sense of, you know, modernity as this era, even in its kind of high times of failing institutions. And so there are bits where I'm actually struggling to remember, because it overlaps between, you know, things that Arendt was writing about in the 40s and things that, you know, much more recently Graeber and Wengrow are writing about, but it comes into this same territory. I mean, I think it is Graeber and Wengrow who sort of talk about precisely what you were just saying, that the, you know, these things that we now hold up as the kind of early achievements of our democratic systems, like the word democracy was nowhere near. I mean, the word democracy was a dirty word until really the 19th, certainly late 18th century anywhere in Europe. So Parliament and Magna Carta and so on were part of something else that no one would have thought of using that language for. And I mean, what Graeber and Wengrow bring to the table partly is the insistence on the role of the voices from elsewhere in the colonial encounters that were going on, of the, you know, indigenous voices in actually seeding some of the ideas of what then gets naturalized and turned into a kind of purely white Western lineage of democracy going back to ancient Greece. But the other bit is that they're also talking about kings and kingship. I mean, Graeber also did a book with Marshall Sahlins on kingship, which I haven't read, but just the stories about the very early finds, the archaeological finds from the last ice age, of these kind of strange little glimmerings of something that looks like a royal burial, and yet you notice that often these are people who clearly had major physical disabilities or whatever it was, things that made them stand out bodily from the people around them within their people, who were being picked and being kind of buried with the kinds of treasures and signs of ceremony that we later associate with kingships. And they have this whole thing, which we've probably talked about before, about the first kings and queens being fairy tale kings and queens, that it starts off as play, it starts off as ritual. There are these clues, these kind of tantalizing signs that what we're looking at is extended periods, you know, thousands of years in which cultures were oscillating backwards and forwards between different forms of social organization, so that there retained a fluidity and a playfulness to it. And I mean, but basically the kind of core argument of the dawn of everything is that the place where we usually start the story of the origins of civilization from might be better understood as the place where we got stuck. But it, as you were talking about, you know, about the David Mitchell book, I was thinking as well about, you know, the strangeness of the king on the chessboard. Like, the king's the most important piece, but can only move one square in any direction. It's actually also quite limited.
Not very powerful and influential.
Well, it's the sort of the fragility, the vulnerability of the formal power or something. I don't know. And then, I mean, even we definitely talked about this once before, but Rowan Williams saying, sort of musing once upon a time before he was Archbishop of Canterbury, about it may be the place where things took a wrong turn in monarchies. Maybe it was when the kings started dressing up in military uniforms. Or maybe it was when they got rid of the sort of the Maundy Thursday service being the monarch literally washing the dirty feet of the poor and replaced it with this euphemistic ceremony of giving away these bags of special coins instead. And the idea that there have been lingering strangenesses that were maybe antidotes to some of the kind of the most toxic forms that monarchy can take, that were eliminated on the journey. And even the idea of the divine right of kings is not this ancient, timeless thing. It was a kind of early modern invention replacing the idea of the king as primus inter pares, the first among equals. And I mean, here in Sweden, they didn't even have a hereditary monarchy until the 16th century. Up to that point, it was an elected monarchy. Now it's elected by the nobles, but it's not quite that. I guess that's the point. When we read these stories of the, you know, aside from all of the kind of surrealism and all of the kind of ugly Game of Thrones style bits of the histories, there's also this sense it's all weirder than we've often just assumed or grown up kind of imbibing when we start to get back into the history of this stuff.
Absolutely. And I've now got an image of, you know, the coronation, where wouldn't it have been more powerful if King Charles had, rather than just having, you know, the sacred olive oil poured on his bonce behind the secretive screen, but he'd actually washed someone's feet by way of his dedication to his role. It's interesting, actually, because you mentioned that. It's just reminded me of Bill Drummond's Belfast Soup story, because one of the artists at that event, a Berlin performance artist called Kiki Twisselman, which is a great name, but she was washing the feet of all of the attendees at that particular party.
There you go. And of course, up here in the Northlands, where the Northmen come from, we've also been thinking about monarchy, because on New Year's Eve, it was Queen Margrethe of Denmark announced that she was going to be abdicating. And as of this weekend, the peaceful handover of power has taken place to Frederick X, or Frederick Twitter, as we used to know him, new king of Denmark.
Oh, you know you've got a long lineage when you're the 10th, don't you? I mean, yes. It's like the French got into the 16th, didn't they? But that's just because they weren't very imaginative and just kept calling everyone Louis. No, it was to say, that's an interesting transition, isn't it? I mean, that brings me on to something that I wanted to also highlight, is this sort of the role of the monarchy in perhaps what our more modern rituals might have to evolve to be. Because, you know, the outgoing Queen of Denmark was a little bit of a climate skeptic. I mean, she was only a couple of years ago sort of questioning the role of humanity in anthropogenic global warming. I think the new King X, as I shall now call him, he is obviously taking a slightly different view. And there's actually, you know, an interesting track record of various different hereditary monarchs taking these positions. I mean, we know, you know, Charles, and we've joked about him being the Green King and not just being a pint of bitter in the UK, and he's got a long sort of heritage of that. But, you know, Prince Albert of Monaco has been heavily involved in ocean conservation for a long time. I know that from my sort of marine biology hat and various different things I've done. And Spain's Queen Letizia, it was even talking about degrowth at the end of last year. So there's a bit of stuff that's interesting going on here. Now, obviously, it's very easy to unpick this or to criticise it, and perhaps with some justification, because it's a bit hypocritical. You know, we know the monarchy here owns vast swathes of land. The crown estates, you know, could be used far more creatively and effectively. I'm sure Chris Smage would love to get his hands on some of the crown estate land for some small farm futures. And I guess the issue is then the coherence of what they're saying and what they're trying to model for people based on the lifestyles that they actually lead. Because we know the way that they always get gagged politically, because of this tension between democratic parliaments and constitutional monarchies. And it's like saying, you know, the king or queen is allowed to say so much, but not to go too far out of line. And I think that's the issue, isn't it? It's like they can't actually probably really speak their hearts and minds. I know Charles has basically had a lot of his speeches edited by Number 10, or they have to go through the Number 10 filter to make sure that they're not too critical of government policy or positioning. But interestingly, you know, again, back to Sweden, because they're related, aren't they? The royal families are cousins, aren't they?
All royal families are related. That's a rule, isn't it?
But, I mean, Sweden's Crown Prince Victoria, you know, has done a book, or she'd contributed a chapter to a book, didn't she, about sort of walking into beautiful places and using public transport and demonstrating that connection. And I think there's something in that, in terms of, you know, the sort of Scandinavian cycling monarchies, and the, I know the Dutch monarchy is into this, obviously, in a cycling nation, but, you know, making those really low carbon behaviours a bit more attractive or engaging. And I actually met the Swedish Crown Princess once.
Did you?
Yes, in Gothenburg, many moons ago, where we were doing a biodiversity communications workshop. So this must be in the late noughties, I guess. But I sat next to her at lunch. You know, we basically, yeah, it was sort of canteen lunch in this Nordens Ark, which is a very interesting, not a zoo, what would you call them now? I guess it's kind of a zoo, but it's a unique place in the fact that they only have animals from that particular latitude of the world. So it's like Siberian tigers and wolverines and that kind of thing. But I sat next to her and chatted away as we'd queued for our canteen lunch. And also Jane Goodall was also at this event. It was quite a sort of gathering, and we sat up late drinking whiskey one night, and Jane Goodall told us this absolutely wonderful story of visiting a friend in New York who she'd been chatting with over dinner, and her friend had this African grey parrot, which we all know, you know, has quite incredible linguistic abilities and obviously very, very smart bird species. But at the end of dinner, they were sort of sat having their coffee, probably another whiskey as a digestif, knowing Jane, and apropos of nothing, the parrot suddenly went, "Where's your monkey?" to the absolute sort of like, not horror, but like, you know, like bewilderment of everyone around the table going, "Well, that's incredible." So the parrot clearly knows who this woman is, and has been listening to a lot of the chimpanzee chat.
I love stories like that. And just like, you don't have to grip tightly onto a way of making sense of it, but it's just like, it cracks open the door of what if there's just a lot more than we're allowed to take seriously, a lot more than we know about going on. I just love that, the power. Where's your monkey then?
Well, exactly. And hearing it from, you know, someone of, you know, the pedigree and intelligence and experience of Jane Goodall was what made it even more both credible and incredible. It was like, wow, that's just a beautiful story.
Yeah, we need a word that's neither credible nor incredible. It's like transcredible. But listen, it's interesting that you were talking about the kind of the green royals and song, because a piece that came my way last week via Caroline Ross, good friend of this podcast, is a piece by Jay Lasole called "Green Elites versus Green Left Populism," and this might kind of like push the other way on this, because we've all, I mean, I remember coming across a hilariously painful example in some sort of green future magazine that I bought at a Swedish railway station a few years back, that had like some Swedish millionaire driving a Tesla the length of Europe was like one of the cover stories. And then there was like a photo of these sort of three grinning kind of Eurotrash elite royal offspring or whatever, promoting their climate fund that they had just launched. And it all just sort of slightly makes you want to vomit. And when I feel like that, it's a piece like Jay Lasole's piece that kind of pulls the other way, because he's like, okay, right, you want to take climate change seriously, so let's get rid of private jets. Are you down with that? And he's talking about this in this context of, you know, barring unforeseen political upheavals, he writes, green policies in the immediate future will largely be imposed on the population by powerful elites which view ordinary people with hostility and contempt and are deeply invested in maintaining their own privilege and dominance. And this really easily fuels the kind of right-wing populism, which we've seen loads of in recent years. And his argument is that you have to, on the one hand, yes, you call out the hypocrisy of the fact that the right-wing populism tends to just be another group of billionaires calling out the first group of billionaires and mobilizing people in the, like, one group saying we're on the side of the people. But he's like, you don't get anywhere unless you also recognize what they're able to draw on. Like, if you hide that out of view, because, you know, the nice billionaires are on the right side of the climate question, but still flying around the world in their private jets, then you don't take any of the wind out of the sails of the right-wing populists. And so he's arguing for what he calls a green left populism. And he has a bunch of examples, but this bit in particular, which is what Caroline had picked out, really sort of struck me. And it's kind of the question that you can make to some of these kind of green elites, if you like, in the cycling royal families of Europe and the rest of it. And he's like that right-wing commentator said, as we progressively ban gas cars, we should absolutely ban private jets. And why not limousines too? The civil disobedience climate activists in Europe have gotten a lot of bad press, including from leftists. But one of their stunts that was universally popular was when they blocked private jets at a German airport. Everybody hates people who travel in private jets, and nobody wants to sacrifice anything while rich people are still doing whatever they want. Make it clear that we won't settle for less than rich people taking trains. It's certainly a thing to throw into the mix, I think, of these conversations as we head into 2024.
Exactly. And I think, you know, this idea of fairness comes through in that sort of left-wing populism. As you say, it's like those billionaires and those people using the private jets or having the incredibly high carbon lifestyles are seen as what we call free riders. You know, they're sort of getting away with it. It's the do what we say, not as we do type of mentality. And I think what's fascinating is, like, that deep root of fairness comes across when you actually discuss these issues with people. And I know some of the outcomes and outputs from citizens' assemblies on climate change tend to bring out these quite radical policy ideas, particularly around things like flying, because the consumption of flying, if you like, the use of flying, is so unevenly distributed across the population. You know, when you get people in a citizens' assembly understanding in the UK, for example, that about 70% of flights are taken by 15% of the population, what you then get is this, well, hang on, you know, well, I don't fly, you know, and or I only fly every other year, or I at most I fly once a year for my annual family holiday. And you get a very swift appreciation that your annual flight is not the problem. The big problem, the big challenge on aviation is the people taking 10 or 12 flights a year. And so I think it plays to this innate sense of fairness. And one of the policy recommendations that often comes out of citizens' assemblies is this frequent flyer levy, where, you know, everyone gets one tax-free flight per year. And for every subsequent flight you take, you pay a ratcheting tax. So it acts as a very powerful economic disincentive because, as you say, private jets aren't kind of welcomed by anyone. And yet their usage is inexorably creeping up. I read a piece about the expansion of Farnborough Airport at the end of last year, where one of the reasons they want to expand flights from Farnborough is for private jet travel for dogs to Dubai. So, you know, people can fly back and forth to the Middle East with their handbag dogs. You know, and it's like, well, I know, and this is the world we live in. And so it's not surprising, actually, there would probably be very, very little public sympathy, you know, for that particular issue. And they've even tried to get a gagging order on one of the local protesters, you know, who's been trying to sort of challenge this sort of idiocy that's going on. And the issue is, in terms of the sort of populism that Jay Soleil is sort of talking about, is often the kind of the techno elite solutions, so-called solutions, always feel very expensive. You know, these upfront capital costs, whether it's like, you know, go and buy an electric vehicle or put photovoltaics on your roof or get a heat pump, they're often quite pricey, whereas these behavioural shifts often don't have a big cost implication because they're just about day-to-day choices and the decisions you make. And so why shouldn't those day-to-day choices be similar for all of us.
So it's interesting you mentioned Citizens Assembly, because what was coming back into my mind is I got like a voice message from Jamie Kelsey Fry.
Yeah.
Who you probably crossed paths with, who's been really involved in Citizens Assemblies and, you know, figuring out how you can do this on a global scale. And I love Jamie. He's great. And he sent me this message. He listened to our live episode that we did in Norwich last year. And he was like, Dougal, you know, it's great, but how many people is this actually talking to? And he's like, you know, what's really powerful is the voices of people who've never felt like they had a voice before. When they start to speak up in assemblies, and then everyone listens. And I've been thinking about that again in the last few days, because I've been sort of heading into 2024, and, you know, 2023 was this year for me of taking At Work in the Ruins out into the world. Like, that was at the center of what I was doing. And, you know, I'm still with that book, still proud of it, and, you know, still doing lots of stuff around it. But this year isn't going to be centered on it in the same way. And then, you know, as you begin to move towards that, you get to go, like, you can kind of come into a more dispassionate relationship with a piece of work than when it's absolutely in the center of what you're doing. And I was realizing that, you know, early on when I was writing that book, I thought of it as kind of closing, in a way, an arc that had begun 15 years earlier when Paul and I wrote the Dark Mountain Manifesto. That what I was doing with this book was kind of putting all sorts of things that I had picked up along the way and been carrying through the work I'd done with Dark Mountain into a book, so that the book can carry those things out into the world rather than me carrying them around. And, you know, for the last year, the difference has been negligible because I've been carrying that book out into the world. But as that book continues to travel further, and as I begin to focus my attention elsewhere, I'm like, oh, okay, so what's left in the space that, having handed on some of that legacy of Dark Mountain, takes me to? And I was taken right back to the beginnings of Dark Mountain, because I had sort of two sides to my life and my work in that era. And, you know, one side of it was Dark Mountain. And I remember saying to people back then, like, this isn't meant to be for everybody. It's not, this is for you if you need it. And it's not got an elevator pitch. It's not got a kind of, there isn't a pop version of it. It's a place you come to when the story you've been inhabiting no longer works, when it no longer makes sense. And we gather around this, you know, around the fire and puzzle this through together. And there was, at the same time, those were the years as well when I founded Spacemakers, and I was doing these projects first at Brixton Village in the indoor market, which was kind of a complex project because we were working for this big private company that owned the market there. And there are lots of issues one way and another with that, but it got a huge amount of attention. And it was, you know, in lots of people's terms, it was a very successful project. And then we got to go on and create the West Norwood Feast, the community-owned and run street market a couple of miles down the road further into South London, which is the project I'm most proud of from that era. But the point was that those projects, they were, you know, they were for everyone in a different way. And that was a big part of my life in that era. And it came out of something that I had learned working with Charlie Davies, who we've talked about now and again on this podcast, who is a dear friend of mine, long-standing collaborator. He'd been the last features editor at The Face magazine, and he set up this email zine, Pick Me Up, that I was one of the editors for. It was a really fascinating gang of people. And he used to always be challenging the rest of us, going, don't be satisfied with making something cool and countercultural, something that only the insiders get. Try and make something that's good, something that your mum gets why it's good, the postman gets why it's good. And it was this kind of valorization of pop. And like now when we're talking in this episode, we're talking about populism. And I it's almost like, you know, make populism good again, maybe is the provocation of this episode. I want to connect that to that pop thing. And you know what's really funny is that I've gone around for 20 years sharing that thing that Charlie taught me about the difference between cool and good, and that cool is this kind of toxic logic that is sort of stuck in trying to impress the people you wanted to impress when you were in high school. And I told Charlie how often I've shared that with people, and he laughed like I don't know what. And then when he finished laughing, he said, "You know where that came from?" I said, "No." And he said, "Jason Donovan." And the the story is that, you know, the Face magazine was nearly bankrupted in the 90s because they wrote a really kind of cruel piece about Jason Donovan, and he brought a libel action against them, and he ended up waiving the damages because otherwise he'd have put them out of business. But nonetheless, that was a big thing in the history of the Face. So when the Face was closing down and Charlie was their last ever features editor, like, among the stories on the cover of their final ever issue, they had an interview with Jason Donovan, and he talked to them about how, like, when he'd sued them, how he was stuck in this thing of wanting to be cool, and the Face was absolutely the embodiment of what being cool would mean. And so it really cut him to the quick when they wrote this piece about him. And he said, and now I've totally let go of that. Now I'm not interested in being cool. I'm doing stuff that's good. And that's where this cool versus good thing comes from. And that there's something much healthier about seeking to do good stuff rather than seeking to do cool stuff. And that was definitely like a part of what I was. It was the balance to the Dark Mountain stuff for me in that era of my life. And I guess I'm now at this place where I'm like, I wonder what that looks like starting from here with the stuff that we've been talking about over the years together. And the other piece, that a couple of other things that fed into this wondering about this at the start of 2024. One was, there's this really beautifully made sort of feature-length documentary called Aftrik Imprint that I was one of the people who's interviewed in, came out in the autumn, and I went to see it, and I thought this is just, you know, it's an example of something that I've seen various versions of, but it's the best made version that I've seen. And it had been kind of co-funded by the Swedish Transition Towns movement. And then a few weeks after I was at the Stockholm premiere of it, a few weeks afterwards, I got a message on Facebook from someone who said, I saw that film that you were in and I really liked it too. And then I showed it to my colleague who I'm, you know, working on this project where we're trying to get everyone on this island where we live off the coast of Sweden involved in this project. And my colleague said, I don't think we should do a screening of this because I'm not sure how many more people besides us it's going to speak to. And I thought back on it. And even though I'd loved the film, I thought I can't really argue back against that, because there's an extent to which, like lots of things that I've been involved in, it's really sort of, it is speaking to the people who are in those rooms, the people who come to Transition Towns meetings, most of whom frankly voted for the same party at the last Swedish general election, which got 4% of the overall vote. And so part of what I'm wondering about with this question about pop and populism is, what do the invitations look like? What do the spaces look like in which we have a far broader range of people in the room taking the microphone in the conversation than the spaces that I often, like, if I'm honest, end up writing and speaking for? And it's not an either or. It's like both things can be needed. But I'm curious just now. And the last clue that I got, you know, in that last episode before Christmas, when I was really exhausted, I mentioned to you about having gone to the committee meeting for the group that's running this music venue, this outdoor venue with the biggest outdoor stage in Sweden that has this extraordinary history to it, where like Simon and Garfunkel and Miriam McCabe and Status Quo and Dave D, Dozy, Mick and Titch, like all these international acts, when they came to Sweden, they'd play at the, you know, the amusement park in Gothenburg, the amusement park in Stockholm, and then they'd play Östervåla. Population 1500, which is, it's just an extraordinary history, an extraordinary story. And I'm sat around the table with this gang of folks who, you know, live in this little town with us, who, and there's like the guy who ran a garage for like 30 years or whatever, and there's the guy who drives a tour bus for bands but also drives the local kindergarten bus, and there's the woman who's a nurse who's got involved, she really wants to sort out the health and safety things at the the venue, and there's a carpenter, and there's a guy who's a manager at our local supermarket here. All right, now this, I'm much more excited about being in a room with this mix of people. I don't even necessarily want to know who everyone voted for in the last general election. I don't really care about it because these people are my neighbours. We're here because we're trying to do something that brings life in the place where we live. And I for a moment, I got like, oh, maybe there's a whole story about, because they said to us, look, next year, 2025 is the 90th anniversary oh, can you try and like work some magic and get some big international act to come and play here? And I got sort of really excited about this. And I was like, maybe this is the embodiment of this kind of pop thing that I'm on the trail of. And I went to Charlie Davies and I said that. And he said, yeah, kind of feels a bit 80s though. Like getting a big international act to come and play in your hometown. So now I'm like, I'm just sitting there wondering like, what the thing that is true to now and also true to the request that's coming to us as incomers into this town from the folks who are running this, whether there's something there. I don't even know what it is, but that's one of the things that I'm sat with.
And what, and that's interesting. So what would that populist, if we took the definition of populism, which is, you know, the approach that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel their concerns are disregarded by established elites, then it'd be interesting. What would be the aspiration or desire, or what would appeal to the people of Ostervaller?
Yeah, and what, or just like what would have the same energy in it that in the 60s and 70s, bringing these massive international acts here had? I don't know the answer to that, but that's just one of the questions that I find myself carrying at the beginning of this year, I guess.
Yeah, I've very much found myself embracing uncertainty. You know, our good friend Sam Gonif has been doing some masterful work on this over the last couple of years, but I don't feel like I have a clear thread which I want to pull on directly. And if you were sort of to compel me to respond in some way, I would say I'm still exploring what that populist project might be. And I'm thinking of, you know, Incredible Edible that we touched on last time,
yes.
Along with the mischievousness of Bill Drummond, and what would those two things look like if, as they came together in a populist way, which would speak to people's hearts in a common sense way, which I think often, even if populism's notion of common sense is often twisted, and certainly we can all think of examples, you know, where the populism is based on a perceived common sense, which isn't sort of stacked up in reality. But, you know, it's a very double-edged sword. You know, you look at what's happening with European farmers at the moment, where there's a sort of resurgent populism in a backlash against a lot of very sensible environmental measures. But because the common sense thread is like, well, we produce the food that everyone eats, and everyone's disconnected from that, and we're serving that fairly basic and fundamental need for everyone, then it's very easy to have a twisted populism. But our challenge, if you like, is to get to that simplicity and accessibility and appeal beyond complexity, on the right side of complexity.
Yeah, it's recognizing the elements of truth within the populist arguments of the kind that we're seeing. And I mean, I found myself going back to something that Chris Smage wrote back in November 2016, straight after Trump was elected. And he was like, well, I've been talking about populism for years, and suddenly everyone's talking about it. And what he was writing was sort of, and this is what he'd been articulating for years at that point, is this idea of a left agrarian populism. And he's like, yeah, absolutely. The danger is the exclusive definition of the people. You know, that's always like the dark, toxic shadow that is invoked, rightly, against, you know, right populism. But what Chris is really, I think, convinced of is that this doesn't exhaust the possibilities of populism. And his definition of it there was really interesting, because he's talking about, you know, it's also characterized by a non-utopian and a non-teleological approach. And he actually picked up on something that I had been quoting around then from this anonymous anarchist text that I'd found from, it must have been quoted in The Mushroom at the End of the World by Anand Singh, actually. But there's this line of, if we don't believe in a global revolutionary future, we must live as we in fact always had to in the present. And like, part of the true common sense thing is the being brought back to the present, being brought back to, you know, how we produce stuff, like what we live off. And one of the pieces that's actually kind of helped me sort of land in the beginning of 2024 was just this little story from Debbie Casper, who's one of the members of our Long Table community, about the day the cow came home. And she's Like, she talks about how her and her other half have been for years, they've had this sort of longing to get into doing some small holding. And she works in academia. This is in North America at a kind of at a college there. And she said she had this moment a couple of years ago of realizing that she'd been resisting at all costs the idea that actually this thing might need to be done in collaboration with her employer, that it might be taking over some disused land on the edge of the college grounds that was the way to make real. And so then they've been doing that. And just before Christmas, they had their first cow arrive. And it's just the way she tells this story, it's just the most beautiful example of how humbling it is to take responsibility for a creature, to get involved with, you know, what's called for in order for what we take for granted to happen. And like the cow arrives and they immediately realize the things they ought to have prepared that they haven't done. And there's this kind of heart-sinking sense of taking responsibility and being out of your depth. And I wrote to her and I said, do you know what? I think it's brilliant that you ended up doing that in the university context, in the higher education context, because that's where that kind of humbling rupture is most needed. Mm. And I thought about what Vanessa says in Hospicing Modernity about how so often our education systems are geared to an education for mastery, when what's called for is an education for depth. And suddenly I saw that depth and humbling are both, they're both about the same axis. They're both about moving downwards on the vertical axis,
yeah,
towards the soil, towards the cow shit. And that it's precisely, I mean, like John Moriarty talks about this. He says, you know, when I was growing up in rural Ireland, if everyone over the age of 14 had just vanished overnight, those of us who were left behind could have run the village, could have run the farms. And according to the logics of education, we knew nothing.
Yeah.
We were ignorant. And so there's something like, for me, that's just this little iconic image at the beginning of 2024, when the cow comes home to the university and you're thrown onto the limits of your knowledge and how all of your high status education doesn't mean that much. There's something there that connects to the bit of truth within the twisted mix of the sort of farmers' movements and so on that you're talking about in the European context. And that's one of the threads I want to follow this year.
You just reminded me as well, my friend, Professor Jonathan Gosling, who came to stay with me here at the end of last year, because he had his, like, I think it must have been the 40-year reunion of his degree in development studies at UEA in Norwich. And he said, you know, he was telling me about his memories of that course. It's interesting in terms of bringing a cow back to campus, because they had a farm, you know, on campus in the 80s. Where they would practice, they would, you know, actually work with some of the animals and some of the agricultural techniques they were going to be trying to take around the world. Now, you can question the efficacy of the practice of some of those things, but at least the cow was home then. It didn't need bringing back home. And I love your point about the depth and the humbling there. And maybe it's apposite then to conclude with a quote I stumbled upon from Bruce Lee, who I think we quoted way back in Be Like Water many moons ago. But Bruce says, to be humble to superiors is duty. To be humble to equals is courtesy. To inferiors is nobleness. And to be humble to all is safety.
There we go. How about that for a motto to hang over the entrance to this year? Happy 2024, Ed. Look forward to seeing where it takes us. Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We're grateful for all the messages we get from listeners and the other ways you support us, sharing these episodes, spreading the word, and rating them on iTunes and elsewhere. To explore further along the paths we walk in these conversations, subscribe to my Substack, Writing Home, and check out the online series at a school called Home. You can also find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling, and Ed is at FruCool on the platform formerly known as Twitter. The Great Humbling is produced by David Benjamin Blower, and the title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions.